Berenvaska, the chief of the Bureau of Commerce, is trying to assimilate the Bureau of Military Procurement, but the generals have him stalemated. Those are the major things in the air right now. There are a number of minor plots going on as well, but nothing earth-shaking enough to divert the spies who are watching us. Can you stir up anything?
Polgara asked, her lips scarcely moving.
I can try, Lady Polgara,
Velvet replied.
But Braedor is right on top of everything that's happening here in the palace. I'll talk with Keldar and Zadi. It is remotely possible that the three of us can engineer something unexpected enough to give us a chance to slip out of the city.
It's getting fairly urgent, Lysel. If Sandramas finds what she is looking for at Ashabar, she will be off again, and we will wind up trailing along behind her in the same way that we were back in Tormurgos.
I will see what we can come up with, my lady,
Velvet promised. Are you going back inside? Belgoroth asked her. She nodded. I'll go with you. He looked around distastefully. All this fresh air and exercise is a little too wholesome for my taste.
Walk a bit farther with me, Geryon, Polgara said. All right.
As Velvet and Belgorath turned back toward the east wing of the palace, Geryon and his aunt strolled on along the neatly trimmed green lawn, laying beneath the blossom-covered trees. A wren, standing on the topmost twig of a gnarled ancient tree, sang as if his heart would burst.
"What's he singing about?"
Geryon asked, suddenly remembering his aunt's unusual affinity for birds.
"He is trying to attract the attention of a female,"
she replied, smiling gently.
"It is that time of year again. Oh, he's being very eloquent, making all sorts of promises, most of which he will break before the summer's over."
He smiled affectionately, put his arm about her shoulders. She sighed happily.
Ah, this is pleasant,
she said.
For some reason, when we are apart, I still think of you as a little boy. It always sort of surprises me to find that you have grown so tall.
There was not too much that he could say to that.
How's Durnik?
He asked.
I almost never see him these days.
He and Toth and Eriond managed to find a well-stocked trout pond on the southern end of the Imperial grounds,
she replied with a slightly comical upward roll of her eyes.
Oh, they're catching large numbers of fish, but the kitchen staff is beginning to get a bit surly about the whole thing.
Trust Durnik to find water, Geryon laughed.
Is Eriond actually fishing, too? That seems a little out of character for him. Oh, I don't think he's very serious about it. He goes along mostly for Durnik's company, I think, and because he likes to be outside.
She paused and then looked directly at him. As so many times in the past, he was suddenly struck to the heart by her luminous beauty.
How has Sinedra been lately?
She's managed to locate a number of young ladies to keep her company. No matter where we go, she's always able to surround herself with companions.
Ladies like to have other ladies about them, dear. Men are nice enough, I suppose, but a woman needs other women to talk to. There are so many important things that men just do not understand.
Her face grew serious.
There has not been any recurrence of what happened in Tormurgos, then?
Not so far as I can tell. She seems fairly normal to me. About the only unusual thing I have noticed is that she never talks about Garen anymore.
That could just be her way of protecting herself, Geryon. She might not be able to put it into words exactly, but she is aware of the melancholia that came over her at Prolgu, and I am sure that she realizes that if she gives in to it, she will be incapacitated. She still thinks about Geryon, I am sure, probably most of the time, but she just won't talk about him.
She paused again.
What about the physical side of your marriage?
She asked him directly. Geryon blushed furiously and then coughed.
Well, there really hasn't been much opportunity for that sort of thing, Aunt Paul. And I think she has too many other things on her mind.
She pursed her lips thoughtfully.
It's not a good idea just to ignore that, Garion, she told him. After a while, people grow apart if they don't periodically renew their intimacy.
He coughed again, still blushing.
She doesn't really seem very interested, Aunt Paul.
Oh, that's your fault, dear. All it takes is a little bit of planning and attention to detail.
You make it sound awfully calculated and cold-blooded.
Spontaneity is very nice, dear, but there's a great deal of charm to a well-planned seduction, too.
Aunt Paul, he gasped, shocked to the core.
You're an adult, Garion, dear, she reminded him. And that's one of an adult male's responsibilities. Think about it. You can be quite resourceful at times. I'm sure you will come up with something.
She looked out over the sun-washed lawns.
Shall we go back inside now? I think it is almost lunchtime.
That afternoon, Garion once again found himself strolling about the palace grounds, this time accompanied by Silk and Tzadi the eunuch.
Belgarath needs a diversion, he told them seriously. I think he has a plan to get us out of the city, but we've got to shake off all of these spies who are watching us long enough for him to put it into motion.
He was busily scratching at his nose as he spoke, his hand covering his mouth.
Hay fever? Silk asked him.
No. Velvet told us that some of Braedor's spies are deaf, but that they can tell what you are saying by watching your lips.
What an extraordinary gift, Tzadi murmured. I wonder if an undeaf man could learn it.
I can think of some times myself when it might have been useful, Silk agreed, covering his mouth as he feigned a cough.
He looked at Tzadi. Can I get an honest answer out of you? He asked.
That depends upon the question, Keldar.
You are aware of the secret language?
Of course.
Do you understand it?
I am afraid not. I have never met a Drasnian who trusted me enough to teach me.
Oh, I wonder why.
Tzadi flashed him a quick grin.
I think we can manage if we cover our mouths when we speak, Garion said.
Won't that become a little obvious after a while?
What are they going to do, tell us to stop?
Probably not. But we might want to pass on some disinformation sometimes. And if they know that we know about this way of listening, we won't be able to do that.
The eunuch sighed about the lost opportunity, then shrugged.
Oh, well, he said.
Garion looked at Silk.
Do you know of anything that's going on that we could use to pull the police off of our trail?
No, not really, the little man replied. At the moment, the Melsine Consortium seems to be concentrating on keeping this year's prize list a secret and trying to persuade Baron Vaska that Jarblek and I should be restrained to those enclaves on the West Coast.
Oh, we've got Vaska pretty much in our pockets, though, as long as he stays bribed.
There's a great deal of secret maneuvering going on, but I don't think anything is so close as to coming to a head right now. Even if it did, it probably wouldn't cause a big enough stink to make the secret police abandon their assignment to watch us.
Why not go right to the top? Tzadi suggested. I could talk to Braedor and see if he is susceptible to bribery.
I don't think so, Garion said. He's having us watched on specific orders from Zakath. I doubt that any amount of money would make him consider risking his head.
There are other ways to bribe people, Belgarion, Tzadi smiled slyly. I have some things in my case that make people feel very good. Oh, the only trouble with them is that after you've used them a few times, you have to keep on using them. The pain of stopping is really quite unbearable. I could bone Braedor within the space of a week, and make him do anything I told him to do."
Geryon felt a sudden surge of profound distaste for that entire notion.
"I'd really rather not do that," he said. "Or only as a last resort."
"You Aelorns have a peculiar notion of morality," the eunuch said, rubbing at his shaved scalp. "You chop people in two without turning a hair, but you get queasy at the idea of poisons or drugs."
"It's a cultural thing, Zadi," Silk told him. "Have you found anything else that might work to our advantage?"
Zadi considered it.
"Not by itself, no," he replied. "A bureaucracy lends itself to endemic corruption, though. There are a number of people in Meloria who take advantage of that. Caravans have a habit of getting waylaid in the Dalazian Mountains, or on the road from Magaren. A caravan needs a permit from the Bureau of Commerce, and Vaska has been known on occasion to sell information about departure times and routes to certain robber chiefs. Or if the price is right, he sells his silence to the merchant barons of Melsine," the eunuch chuckled. "Once he sold information about one single caravan to three separate robber bands. There was a pitched battle on the plains of Delchin, or so I'm told."
Geryon's eyes narrowed in thought.
"I'm beginning to get the feeling that we might want to concentrate our attention on this Baron Vaska. Velvet told us that he is also trying to take the Bureau of Military Procurement away from the army."
"I didn't know that," Silk said with some surprise.
"Little Isel is developing quite rapidly, isn't she?"
"It's the dimples, Prince Skeldar," Zadi said. "I'm almost totally immune to any kind of feminine blandishment, but I have to admit that when she smiles at me, my knees turn to butter. She's absolutely adorable, and totally unscrupulous, of course."
Silk nodded.
"Yes, we are moderately proud of her."
"Why don't you two go look her up?" Geryon suggested. "Pool your information about this highly corruptible Baron Vaska. Maybe we can stir something up, something noisy. Open fighting in the halls of the palace might just be the sort of thing we need to cover our escape."
"You have a genuine flair for politics, Belgarion," Zadi said admiringly.
"I'm a quick learner," Geryon admitted. "And, of course, I keep company with some very disreputable men."
"Thank you, Your Majesty," the eunuch replied, with mock appreciation.
Shortly after supper, Geryon walked through the halls of the palace for his customary evening conversation with Zakath. As always, a soft-footed secret policeman trailed along some distance behind. Zakath's mood that evening was pensive, almost approaching the bleak, icy melancholy that had marked him back in Rakhaga.
"Bad day?"
Geryon asked him, removing a sleeping kitten from the carpet-covered footstool in front of his chair. Then he leaned back and set his feet on the stool. Zakath made a sour face.
"I have been whittling away at all of the work that piled up while I was in Tor Murgos. The problem is that now that I am back, the pile just keeps getting higher."
"I know the feeling," Geryon agreed. "When I get back to Riva, it's probably going to take me a year to clear my desk. Are you open to a suggestion?"
"Suggest away, Geryon. Right now, I will listen to anything."
He looked reprovingly at the black-and-white kitten who was biting his knuckles again.
"Not so hard,"
he murmured, tapping the ferocious little beast on the nose with his forefinger. The kitten laid back its ears and growled a squeaky little growl at him.
"I'm not trying to be offensive or anything," Geryon began cautiously.
But I think you are making the same mistake that Urgot made.
That's an interesting observation. Go on.
It seems to me that you need to reorganize your government.
Zakath blinked. Now, that is a major proposal. I don't get the connection, though. Urgot was a hopeless incompetent. At least he was before you came along and taught him the fundamentals of ruling. What is this mistake that he and I have in common?
Urgot is a coward, Geryon said, and probably always will be.
You are not a coward. Sometimes a bit crazy, maybe, but never a coward.
The problem is that you are both making the same mistake. You are trying to make all of the decisions yourselves, even the little ones. Even if you stop sleeping altogether, you won't find enough hours in the day to do that.
So I have noticed. What is the solution?
Delegate responsibility. Your bureau chiefs and generals are competent. Corrupt, I'll grant you, but they know their jobs. Tell them to take care of things and only bring you the major decisions. And tell them that if anything goes wrong, you will replace them.
That is not the Angrak way, Geryon. The ruler, or emperor in this case, has always made all decisions. It has been that way since before the cracking of the world. Torak made every decision in antiquity, and the emperors of Meloria have followed that example, no matter what we may have felt about him personally.
Urgot made the exact same mistake, Geryon told him. What you are both forgetting is that Torak was a god, and his mind and will were unlimited. Human beings cannot possibly hope to imitate that sort of thing.
None of my bureau chiefs or generals could be trusted with that kind of authority, Zakath said, shaking his head. They are almost out of control as it is.
Oh, they'll learn the limits, Geryon assured him. After a few of them have been demoted or dismissed, the rest will get the idea.
Zakath smiled bleakly. That is also not the Angrak way, Geryon. When I make an example of someone, it usually involves the headsman's block.
That's an internal matter, of course, Geryon admitted. You know your people better than I do. But if a man has talent, you can't really call on him again if you have removed his head, can you? Don't waste talent, Zakath. It's too hard to come by.
You know something, Zakath said with a slightly amused look. They call me the Man of Ice. But in spite of your mild-seeming behavior, you are even more cold-blooded than I am. You are the most practical man that I have ever met.
I was raised in Sindaria, Zakath, Geryon reminded him. Practicality is a religion there. I learned to run a kingdom from a man named Faldor. A kingdom is very much like a farm, really. Seriously, though, the major goal of any ruler is to keep things from flying apart, and gifted subordinates are too valuable a resource to waste. I've had to reprimand a few people, but that's as far as it ever went. That way, they were still around in case I needed them. You might want to think about that a little bit.
I will consider it, Zakath straightened. By the way, speaking of corruption in government...
Oh? Were we speaking about that?
We are about to. My bureau chiefs are all more or less dishonest, but your three friends are adding levels of sophistication to the petty scheming and deceit here in the palace that we are not really prepared to cope with.
Oh?
The lovely Margravine Lysel has actually managed to persuade the King of Palia and the Prince Regent of Delshin that she is going to intercede with you in their behalf. Each of them is absolutely convinced that their long-term squabble is about to come out into the open. I do not want them to declare war on each other. I have got trouble in Karanda already.
I'll have a word with her, Garion promised.
And Prince Keldar virtually owns whole floors of the Bureau of Commerce. He is getting more information out of there than I am. The merchants in Melsin gather every year to set prices for just about everything that is sold in Meloria. It is the most closely guarded secret in the Empire. And Keldar just bought it. He has deliberately been undercutting those prices, and he is disrupting our whole economy.
Garion frowned. He didn't mention that.
I do not mind his making a reasonable profit, as long as he pays his taxes. But I cannot really have him gaining absolute control over all commerce in Meloria, can I? He is an Elon, after all. And his political loyalties are a little obscure.
I'll suggest that he moderate his practices a bit. You have to understand Silk, though. I don't believe he even cares about the money. All he's interested in is the game.
It is still Sadi. Who concerns me the most, though?
Oh?
He has become rather intensely involved in agriculture.
Sadi?
There's a certain plant that grows wild in the marshes of Kamat. Sadi is paying a great deal for it. And one of our prominent bandit chiefs has put all of his men to work harvesting it. And protecting the crop, of course. There have already been some pitched battles up there, I understand.
A bandit who is harvesting crops is too busy to be robbing travelers on the highways, though, Garion pointed out.
That is not exactly the point, Garion. I did not mind so much when Sadi was making a few officials feel good and act foolish. But he is importing this plant into the city by the wagon load and spreading it around through the workforce and the army. I don't care for the idea at all.
I'll see what I can do to get him to suspend operations, Garion agreed. Then he looked at the Melorian Emperor through narrowed eyes. You do realize, though, that if I rein the three of them in, they'll just switch over to something new, and probably just as disruptive. Wouldn't it be better if I just took them out of Malzeth entirely?
Sakath smiled. Nice try, Garion. But I don't think so. I think we will just wait until my army gets back from Tol Muragos. Then we can all ride out of Malzeth together.
You are the most stubborn man I have ever met, Garion said with some heat. Can't you get it through your head that time is slipping away from us? This delay could be disastrous, not only for you and me, but for the whole world.
The fabled meeting between the Child of Light and the Child of Dark again. I am sorry, Garion, but Sandramas is just going to have to wait for you. I don't want you and Belgarath roaming at will through my empire. I like you, Garion, but I do not altogether trust you.
Garion's temper began to heat up. He thrust his jaw out pugnaciously as he rose to his feet.
My patience is starting to wear a little thin, Sakath. I have tried to keep things between us more or less civil, but there is a limit, and we are getting rather close to it. I am not going to lie around your palace for 3 months.
That is where you are wrong, Sakath snapped,
also rising to his feet and unceremoniously dumping the surprised kitten to the floor. Garion ground his teeth together, trying to get his temper under control.
Up to now, I've been polite, but I would like to remind you about what happened back at Rakhaga. We can leave here any time we want to, you know.
And the minute you do, you are going to have three of my regiments right on your heels.
Zakath was beginning to shout now. "Not for very long," Geryon replied ominously.
"What are you going to do?" Zakath demanded scornfully. "Turn all of my troops into toads or something?" "No, Geryon. I know you well enough to know that you would not do that."
Geryon straightened.
"You're right," he said. "I wouldn't. But I was thinking of something a bit more elemental. Torak used the orb to crack the world, remember? I know how it was done, and I could do it myself if I had to. Your troops are going to have a great deal of trouble following us if they suddenly run into a trench 10 miles deep and 50 miles wide, stretching all the way across the middle of Meloria."
"You wouldn't," Zakath gasped.
"Try me."
With a tremendous effort, Geryon brought his anger under control.
"I think perhaps it is time for us to break this off," he said. "We're starting to shout threats at each other like a pair of schoolboys. Why don't we continue this conversation some other time, after we have both had a chance to cool off a bit?"
He could see a hot retort hovering on Zakath's lips. But then, the Emperor also drew himself up and regained his composure, though his face was still pale with anger.
"I think perhaps you are right."
Geryon nodded curtly and started toward the door.
"Geryon," Zakath said then.
"Yes?"
"Sleep well."
"You too."
Geryon left the room. Her Imperial Highness, the Princess Zinedra, Queen of Riva, and beloved of Belgarion, Overlord of the West, was feeling pecky. Pecky was not a word that Her Imperial Highness would normally have used to describe her mood. Disconsolate or out of sorts might have had a more aristocratic ring, but Zinedra was honest enough with herself privately to admit that pecky probably came closer to the mark. She moved irritably from room to room in the luxurious apartment Zakath had provided for her and Geryon, with the hem of her favorite teal-green dressing gown trailing along behind her bare feet. She suddenly wished that breaking a few dishes would not appear quite so unladylike. A chair got in her way. She almost kicked it, but remembered at the last instant that she was not wearing shoes. Instead, she deliberately took the cushion from the chair and set it on the floor. She plumped it a few times, then straightened. She lifted the hem of her dressing gown to her knees, squinted, swung her leg a few times for practice, and then kicked the cushion completely across the room.
"There,"
she said.
"Take that."
For some reason, it made her feel a little better. Geryon was away from their rooms at the moment, engaged in his customary evening conversation with Emperor Zakath. Zinedra wished that he were here so that she could pick a fight with him. A nice little fight right now might modify her mood. She went through a door and looked at the steaming tub sunk into the floor. Perhaps a bath might help. She even went so far as to dip an exploratory toe in the water, then decided against it. She sighed and moved on. She paused for a few moments at the window of the unlighted sitting room that overlooked the verdant atrium at the center of the east wing of the palace. The full moon had risen early that day, and stood high in the sky, filling the atrium with its pale, colorless light, and the pool at the center of the private little court reflected back that perfect white circle of the Queen of the Night. Zinedra stood for quite some time, looking out at the window, lost in thought. She heard the door open and then slam shut.
"Zinedra, where are you?"
Geryon's voice sounded a trifle testy.
"I am in here, dear."
"Why are you standing around in the dark?" he asked, coming into the room.
"I was just looking at the moon. Do you realize that it is the same moon that shines down on Tolhanath? And Riva, too, for that matter.
I hadn't really thought about it, he replied shortly.
Why are you being so grumpy with me?
Oh, it's not you, Sinedra, he answered apologetically. I had another fight with Zakath, is all.
That is getting to be a habit.
Why is he so unreasonably stubborn? Geryon demanded.
That's part of the nature of kings and emperors, dear.
What's that supposed to mean?
Nothing.
Do you want something to drink? I think we've still got some of that wine left.
I don't think so. Not right now.
Well, I do. After my little chat with his pig-headed imperialness, I need something to calm my nerves. He went back out, and she heard the clink of a decanter against the rim of a goblet. Out in the moon-bright atrium, something moved out from the shadows of the tall, broad-leafed trees. It was Silk. He was wearing only his shirt and hose. He had a bath sheet over his shoulder, and he was whistling. He bent at the edge of the pool and dipped his fingers into the water. Then he stood up and began to unbutton his shirt. Zenedra smiled, drew back behind the drape, and watched as the little man disrobed. Then he stepped down into the pool, shattering the reflected moon into a thousand sparkling fragments. Zenedra continued to watch as he lazily swam back and forth in the moon-dappled water. Then there was another shadow under the trees, and Lyssel came out into the moonlight. She wore a loose-fitting robe, and there was a flower in her hair. The flower was undoubtedly red, but the wan light of the full spring moon leached away the color, making it appear black against the blonde girl's pale hair.
"How's the water?"
she asked quite calmly. Her voice seemed very close, almost as if she were in the same room with the watching Zenedra. Silk gave a startled exclamation, then coughed as his mouth and nose filled with water. He spluttered, then recovered his composure. "Not bad," he replied in an unruffled tone.
"Good,"
Lyssel said. She moved to the edge of the pool.
"Keldar, I think it is time that we had a talk."
"Oh? About what?"
"About this."
Quite calmly, she unbelted her robe and let it fall to the ground about her feet. She was not wearing anything under the robe.
"You seem to have a little difficulty grasping the idea that things change with the passage of time,"
she continued, dipping one foot into the water. Quite deliberately, she pointed at herself.
"This is one of those things."
"I noticed that," he said admiringly.
"I'm so glad. I was beginning to be afraid that your eyes might be failing."
She stepped down into the pool and stood waist deep in the water.
"Well?"
she said then. "Well, what?"
"What do you plan to do about it?"
She reached up and took the flower from her hair and carefully laid it on the surface of the pool. Zenedra darted to the door on silent bare feet.
"Geryon,"
she called in an urgent whisper.
"Come here."
"Why?"
"Keep your voice down and come here."
He grumbled slightly and came into the darkened room.
"What is it?"
She pointed at the window with a muffled giggle.
"Look,"
she commanded in a delighted little whisper. Geryon went to the window and looked out. After a single glance, he quickly averted his eyes. "Oh, my," he said in a strangled whisper. Zenedra giggled again, came to his side, and burrowed her way under his arm.
"Isn't that sweet?"
she said softly. "I'm sure it is," he whispered back. "But I don't think we ought to watch."
"Why not?"
The flower Lyssel had laid on the water had floated across the intervening space, and Silk, his expression bemused, picked it up and smelled it. "Yours, I believe," he said,
holding it out to the pale-skinned girl sharing the pool with him.
"Why, yes, I believe it is," she replied. "But you have not answered my question."
"Which question?"
"What are you going to do about this?"
"I'll think of something."
"Good. I'll help you."
Geryon firmly reached out and pulled the drape shut.
"You spoil a sport,"
Zinedra pouted. "Never mind," he told her. "Now, come away from the window." He drew her out of the room. "I can't understand what she's up to," he said.
"I thought that was fairly obvious."
"Zinedra?"
"She is seducing him, Geryon. She has been in love with him since she was a little girl. And she's finally decided to take steps. I'm so happy for her that I could just burst."
He shook his head. "I will never understand women. Just when I think I've got everything worked out, you all get together and change the rules. You wouldn't believe what Aunt Paul said to me just this morning."
"Oh, what was that?"
"She said that I ought to..." He stopped abruptly, his face suddenly going beet red. "Never mind," he added lamely.
"What was it?"
"I'll tell you some other time." He gave her a peculiar look then. It was a look she thought she recognized. "Have you taken your evening bath yet?" he asked with exaggerated casualness.
"Not yet. Why?"
"I thought I might join you, if you don't mind." Zinedra artfully lowered her lashes.
"If you really want to,"
she said in a girlish voice. "I'll light some candles in there. The lamp's a bit bright, don't you think?"
"Whatever you prefer, dear."
"And I think I'll bring in the wine, too. It might help us to relax."
Zinedra felt an exultant little surge of triumph. For some reason, her irritability had entirely disappeared.
"I think that would be just lovely, dear."
"Well," he said, extending a slightly trembling hand to her, "shall we go in, then?"
"Why don't we?"
Chapter 10 The following morning, when they gathered for breakfast, Silk's expression was faintly abstracted, as if he had just realized that someone had, somehow, out-bargained him. The little man steadfastly refused to look at Velvet, who kept her eyes demurely on the bowl of strawberries and cream that she was eating.
"You seem a trifle out of sorts this morning, Prince Keldar,"
Zinedra said to him in an offhand manner, though her eyes sparkled with suppressed mirth.
"Whatever is the matter?"
He threw her a quick, suspicious look.
"There, there,"
she said, fondly patting his hand.
"I am sure that you will feel much better after breakfast."
"I'm not very hungry," he replied. His voice was just a little sullen.
He stood abruptly.
"I think I will go for a walk," he said.
"But my dear fellow,"
she protested.
"You haven't eaten your strawberries. They're absolutely delicious, aren't they, Lacelle?"
"Marvelous,"
the blonde girl agreed, with only the faintest hint of her dimples showing. Silk's scowl deepened, and he marched resolutely toward the door.
"May I have yours, Keldar?"
Velvet called after him.
"If you're not going to eat them, that is..."
He slammed the door as he went out, and Zinedra and Velvet exploded into gales of silvery laughter.
"What is this?"
Polgara asked them.
"Oh, nothing,"
Zinedra said, still laughing.
"Nothing at all, Lady Polgara. Prince Keldar had a little adventure last night, and that didn't turn out exactly the way he expected it to."
Velvet gave Zinedra a quick look and flushed slightly. Then she laughed again. Polgara looked at the giggling pair, and then one of her eyebrows went up.
"Oh, I see," she said.
The flush on Velvet's cheeks grew rosier, although she continued to laugh.
Oh, dear, Polgara sighed.
Is something wrong, Paul?
Durnick asked her. She looked at the good, honest man, assessing his strict Sindarian principles.
Just a small complication, Durnick, she replied. Nothing that can't be managed.
Oh, that's good.
He pushed back his bowl.
Do you need me for anything this morning?
No, dear,
she replied, kissing him. He returned her kiss and then stood up, looking across the table at Toth and Eriond, who sat waiting expectantly.
Where shall we go, then?
He asked them. The three of them trooped out, their faces alight with anticipation.
I wonder how long it's going to take them to empty all of the fish out of that pond, Polgara mused.
Forever, I am afraid, Lady Polgara,
Zadi told her, popping a strawberry into his mouth.
The groundskeepers restock it every night.
She sighed.
Oh, I was afraid of that.
About mid-morning, Geryon was pacing up and down one of the long, echoing halls. He felt irritable, and a sort of frustrated impatience seemed to weigh him down. The urgent need to get to Asheba, before Zandramas escaped him again, was so constantly on his mind now that he could think of almost nothing else. Although they had come up with several possible schemes, Silk, Velvet, and Zadi were still searching for a suitable diversion, something startling enough to draw off Brador's secret policemen so that they could all make good their escape. There was obviously little chance of changing Zakath's mind, and it began to look increasingly as if Geryon and his friends were going to have to do it the other way, as Belgareth sometimes put it. Despite his occasional threats to Zakath, Geryon did not really want to do that. He was quite sure that to do so would permanently end his growing friendship with this strange man who ruled Meloria. He was honest enough to admit that it was not only the friendship he would regret losing, but the political possibilities implicit in the situation as well. He was about to return to his rooms when a scarlet-liveried servant came up to him.
"Your Majesty,"
the servant said with a deep bow,
"Prince Keldar asked me to find you for him. He would like to have a word with you."
"Where is he?"
Geryon asked.
"In the formal garden near the north wall of the complex, Your Majesty. There is a half-drunk Nadrak with him, and a woman with a remarkably foul mouth. You would not believe some of the things she said to me."
"I think I know her," Geryon replied, with a faint smile. "I'd believe it."
He turned then and walked briskly through the hallways and out into the palace grounds. Yarblek had not changed. Though it was pleasantly warm in the neatly manicured formal garden, he nonetheless still wore his shabby felt overcoat and his shaggy fur hat. He was sprawled on a marble bench under a leafy arbor with a broached ale keg conveniently at his hand. Vela, as lush as ever, wandered idly among the flower beds, dressed in her tight-fitting Nadrak vest and leather trousers. Her silver-hilted daggers protruded from the tops of her boots and from her belt, and her walk was still that same challenging, sensual strut, a mannerism she had practiced for so long that it was by now automatic, and probably even unconscious. Silk sat on the grass near Yarblick's bench, and he too held an ale cup.
"I was just about to come looking for you," he said as Geryon approached.
The rangy Yarblek squinted at Geryon.
"Well, well," he said, blinking owlishly. "If it isn't the boy king of Riva. I see that you are still wearing that big sword of yours."
"It's a habit," Geryon shrugged. "You're looking well, Yarblek. Aside from being a little drunk, that is."
"I've been cutting down," Yarblek said rather piously. "My stomach is not what it used to be."
"Did you happen to see Belgarath on your way here?"
Silk asked Geryon.
No. Should I have?
I sent for him, too. Yarblick has got some information for us, and I want the old man to get it first hand.
Geryon looked at Silk's coarse-faced partner.
How long have you been in Malzath?
We got in last night,
Yarblick replied, dipping his cup into the ale keg again.
Dolmar told me that you were all here in the palace, so I came by this morning to look you up.
How long are you going to stay in town?
Silk asked him. Yarblick tugged at his scraggly beard and squinted up at the arbor.
Hey, that's kind of hard to say. Dolmar picked up most of what I need. But I want to nose around the markets a bit. There is a Tonedrin in Boktor who said that he's interested in uncut gemstones. I could pick up a quick fortune on that transaction, particularly if I could sneak the stones past Dresnian customs.
Don't Queen Porin's customs agents search your packs pretty thoroughly?
From top to bottom, Yarblick laughed. And they pat me down as well. They don't, however, lay one finger on Vela. They have all learned how quick she is with her daggers. I have made back what I paid for her a dozen times over by hiding little packages here and there in her clothes.
He laughed coarsely.
And, of course, the hiding is sort of fun, too.
He belched thunderously.
Pardon me, he said.
Belgarath came across the lawn. The old man had resisted all of Zakath's tactful offers of less disreputable raiment, and still wore, defiantly, Geryon thought, his stained tunic, patched hose, and mismatched boots.
"Well, I see that you finally got here," he said to Yarblick, without any preamble.
"I got tied up in Malkamat," the Nadrak replied. "Karl Zakath is commandeering ships all up and down the west coast to bring his army back from stinking Tol Murgos. I had to hire boats and hide them in the marshes north of the ruins of Tol Mishrak."
He pointed at the ale keg.
"Hey, you want some of this?"
"Naturally. Have you got another cup?"
Yarblick patted here and there at his voluminous coat, reached into an inside pocket and drew out a squat, dented tankard.
"I like a man who comes prepared."
"A proper host is always ready. Help yourself. Just try not to spill too much."
The Nadrak looked at Geryon.
"How about you? I think I could find another cup."
"No, thanks anyway, Yarblick. It's a little early for me."
Then a short, gaudily dressed man came around the arbor. His clothes were a riot of frequently conflicting colors. One sleeve was green, the other red. One leg of his hose was striped in pink and yellow, and the other covered with large blue polka dots. He wore a tall, pointed cap with a bell attached to the peak. It was not his outrageous clothing that was so surprising, however. What caught Geryon's eye first was the fact that the man was quite casually walking on his hands with both feet extended into the air.
"Did I hear somebody offer somebody a little drop of something to drink?"
he asked, in a strange, lilting brogue that Geryon did not quite recognize. Yarblick gave the colorful little fellow a sour look and reached inside his coat again. The acrobat flexed his shoulders, thrusting himself into the air, flipped over in midair, and landed on his feet. He briskly brushed off his hands and came toward Yarblick with an ingratiating smile. His face was nondescript, the kind of face that would be forgotten almost as soon as it was seen, but for some reason it seemed to Geryon to be naggingly familiar.
"Ah, good Master Yarblick," the man said to Silk's partner. "I'm sure that you're the kindest man alive. I was near to perishing of thirst, don't you know?"
He took the cup, dipped into the ale keg, and drank noisily. Then he let out his breath with a gusty sound of appreciation.
"'Tis a good brew you have there, Mr. Yarblick," he said, dipping again into the keg.
Belgarath had a peculiar expression on his face, partly puzzled, but at the same time partially amused.
"He came tagging along when we left Malkamat," Yarblek told them. "Vela finds him amusing, so I haven't chased him off yet. She turns a little shrill when she doesn't get her own way." "The name is Feldegast, fine gentleman," the gaudy little fellow introduced himself with an exaggerated bow. "Feldegast the juggler. I be also an acrobat, as you've seen for yourselves, a comedian of no mean ability and an accomplished magician. I can baffle your eyes with me unearthly skill at prestidigitation, don't you know? I can also play rousing tunes on a little wooden whistle, or, if your mood be melancholy, I can play ye sad songs on the lute to bring a lump to your throat and fill your eyes with sweet, gentle tears. Would you be wanting to witness some of me unspeakable talent?"
"Maybe a little later," Belgareth told him, his eyes still a little bemused. "Right now, we have some business to discuss."
"Take another cup of ale and go entertain Vela, comedian," Yarblek said to him. "Tell her some more off-color stories." "It'll be me eternal delight, good Master Yarblek,"
the outrageous fellow said grandly.
"She's a good strapping wench, with a lusty sense of humor and a fine appreciation for body stories."
He dipped out more ale and then capered across the lawn toward the dark-haired Nadrak girl.
"You're disgusting," Yarblek growled, looking after him. "Some of the stories he tells her make my ears burn, but the nastier they are, the harder she laughs."
He shook his head moodily. "Let's get down to business," Belgareth said. "We need to know what's going on in Karanda, right now."
"Well, that's simple," Yarblek told him. "Minga, that's what's going on. Minga and his cursed demons."
"And Dolmar filled us in," Silk said. "We know about what happened at Kalida, and about the way that the Karans are flocking in to join his army from all over the Seven Kingdoms. Is he making any moves toward the south yet?"
Not that I've heard," Yarblek replied. "He seems to be consolidating things through the north right now. He's whipping all of the Karans into hysteria, though. If Sakath doesn't do something quickly, he's going to have a full-scale revolution on his hands. I can tell you, though, that it's not safe to travel in northern Karanda right now. Minga's shrieking Karans control everything to the coast of Zamad."
"We have to go to Ashaba,"
Geryon told him.
"I would not advise it,"
Yarblek said bluntly. "The Karans are picking up some very unsavory habits."
"Oh," Silk said.
"I am an Angorak," Yarblek said. "And I've been watching Grolems cut out human hearts to offer to Torak since I was a boy. But what's happening in Karanda turns even my stomach. The Karans stake captives out on the ground and then call up their demons. The demons are all getting fat."
"Would you care to be a little more specific?"
"Not really." "Use your imagination, Silk. You've been in Marindland. You know what demons eat."
"Oh, you're not serious."
"Oh, yes. And the Karans eat the scraps. As I said, some very unsavory habits. There are also some rumors about the demons breeding with human females."
"That's abominable," Geryon gasped.
"It is indeed," Yarblek agreed with him. "The women usually don't survive their pregnancies. But I have heard of a few live births."
"We have to put a stop to that," Belgareth said bleakly.
Good luck," Yarblek said. "Me? I'm going back to Garog Nadrak just as soon as I can get my caravan put together. I'm not going anywhere near Minga, or the tame demon he keeps on a leash."
"Nehaz?"
Geryon asked.
"Ah, you've heard the name, then?"
"Dolmar told us."
"We should probably start with him,"
Belgorath said. If we can drive Nahez back to wherever he came from, it's likely that the rest of the demons will follow their lord. Neat trick, Yarblick grunted. I have certain resources, the old man told him. Once the demons are gone, Minga won't have anything left but a ragtag army of Kerendese fanatics. We will be able to go on about our business and leave the mopping up to Zakath. He smiled briefly. That might occupy his mind enough to keep him from breathing down our necks. Vela was laughing raucously as she and Feldegast, the juggler, approached the arbor. The little comedian was walking on his hands again, erratically and with his feet waving ludicrously in the air.
He tells a good story,
the lush-bodied Nadrak girl said, still laughing.
But he can't hold his liquor.
I didn't think he drank all that much, Silk said.
It wasn't the ale that fuddled him so bad, she replied.
She drew a silver flask from under her belt.
I gave him a pull or two at this.
Her eyes suddenly sparkled with mischief.
Care to try some, Silk?
She offered, holding out the flask. What's in it? He asked suspiciously.
Just a little drink we brew in Garak Nadrak,
she said innocently.
It's as mild as mother's milk,
she demonstrated by taking a long drink from the flask. Othless? She nodded. Oh, no thanks, he shuddered. The last time I drank that, I lost track of a whole week.
Don't be so chicken-livered, Silk,
she told him scornfully. She took another drink.
See? It doesn't hurt a bit.
She looked at Garion.
My lord,
she said to him.
How's your pretty little wife?
She's well, Vela.
I'm glad to hear that. Have you got her pregnant again yet?
Garion flushed.
No,
he replied.
Oh, you're wasting time, my lord. Why don't you run back to the palace and chase her around the bedroom a time or two?
Then she turned to Belgorath.
Well?
She said to him. Well, what? She smoothly drew one of her knives from her belt.
Would you like to try again?
She asked, turning deliberately so that her well-rounded posterior was available to him. Thanks, all the same, Vela, he said with a kind of massive dignity. But it's a bit early.
Oh, that's all right, old man,
she said.
I'm ready for you this time. Any time you're in a patting frame of mind, feel free. I sharpened all my knives before we came, especially for you.
Oh, you're too kind. The drunken Feldegast lurched, tried to regain his balance, and toppled over in an unceremonious heap. When he stumbled to his feet, his plain face was splotched and distorted, and he stood hunched over with his back bowed to the point where he almost looked deformed. "I think the girl got the best of you, my friend," Belgorath said jovially, as he moved quickly to help the inebriated juggler to right himself. "You really ought to straighten up, though. If you stand around bent over like that, you will tie your insides in knots." Garion saw his grandfather's lips moving slightly as he whispered something to the tipsy entertainer. Then, so faint that it was barely discernible, he felt the surge of the old man's will. Feldegast straightened, his face buried in his hands.
"Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear," he said. "Have you poisoned me? Me, girl?" he demanded of Vela. "I can't remember ever being taken by the drink so fast."
He took his hands away. The splotches and distortion were gone from his face, and he looked as he had before. "Don't ever try to drink with a Nadrak woman," Belgorath advised him, "particularly when she is the one who brewed the liquor."
"It seems that I heard a snatch of conversation whilst I was entertaining the wind cheer. Is it Coranda you be talking about and the woeful things happening there?
We were, Belgarath admitted.
I display me talents betimes in wayside inns and taverns, for pennies and a drink or two, don't you know, and a great deal of information comes into places like that. Sometimes, if you make a man laugh and be merry, you can draw more out of him than you can with silver or strong drink. As it happened, I was in such a place not long ago, dazzling the onlookers with the brilliance of me performance, and happens that whilst I was there, a wayfarer came in from the east. A great brute of a man he was. He told us of the distressful news from Coranda. And after he had eaten and finished more pots of good strong ale than was good for him, I sought him out and questioned him further. A man in me profession can't never know too much about the places where he might be called upon to display his art, don't you know? This great brute of a man, who should not have feared anything, walks and was a-shaking and trembling like a frightened babe. And he tells me that I should stay out of Coranda as I valued my life. Then he tells me a very strange thing, which I have not yet put the meaning to. It tells me that the road between Kalida and Malyaska is thick with messengers going to and fro, hither and yon. Isn't that an amazing thing? How could a man account for it? But there be strange things going on in the world, good masters, and wonders to behold that no man at all could ever begin to imagine.
The juggler's lilting brogue was almost hypnotic in its charm and liquidity. Geryon found himself somehow caught up in the really quite commonplace narrative. He felt a peculiar disappointment as the gaudy little man broke off his story.
"I hope that me tale has brought ye some small entertainment, an enlightenment, good masters,"
Feldegast said ingratiatingly. His grass-stained hand held out suggestively.
"I make me way in the world with me wits and me talents, given of them as free as the birds, but I'm always grateful for little tokens of appreciation, don't you know?"
"Pay him," Belgarath said shortly to Geryon.
"What?"
"Give him some money."
Geryon sighed and reached for the leather purse at his belt.
"May the gods all smile down on you, young master."
Feldegast thanked Geryon effusively for the few small coins which changed hands. Then he looked slyly at Vela.
"Tell me, girl, have you ever heard the story of the milkmaid and the peddler? I must give you fair warning that it's a naughty little story, and I'd be covered with shame to bring a blush to your fair cheeks."
"I haven't blushed since I was 14,
Vela said to him.
"Well, then, why don't we go apart a ways, and I'll see if I can remedy that. I'm told that blushing is good for the complexion."
Vela laughed and followed him back out onto the lawn.
"Silk," Belgarath said brusquely. "I need that diversion, now."
"We don't really have anything put together yet," Silk objected.
"Make something up, then."
The old man turned to Yarblick.
"And I don't want you to leave Malzeth until I give you the word. I might need you here."
"What's the matter, Grandfather?"
Geryon asked.
"We have to leave here, as quickly as possible."
Out on the lawn, Vela stood wide-eyed and with the palms of her hands pressed to her flaming cheeks.
"You'll have to admit that I warned ye, me girl,"
Feldegast chortled triumphantly.
"Which is more than I can say about the deceitful way ye slipped your dreadful brew into me craw."
He looked at her admiringly.
"I must say, though, that you bloom like a red, red rose when you blush like that, and you're a joy to behold in your maiden-like confusion. Tell me, have you heard by chance the one about the shepherdess and the knight-errant?"
Vela fled. That afternoon, Silk, who normally avoided anything remotely resembling physical exertion, spent several hours in the leafy atrium in the center of the east wing, busily piling stones across the mouth of the tiny rivulet of fresh, sparkling water which fed the pool at the center of the little garden. Geryon watched curiously from the window of his sitting room until he could stand it no longer. He went out into the atrium to confront the sweating little Drasnian. "Are you taking up landscaping as a hobby?"
"No," Silk replied, mopping his forehead. "Just taking a little precaution is all."
"Precaution against what?"
Silk held up one finger.
"Wait," he said, gauging the level of the water rising behind his improvised dam. After a moment, the water began to spill over into the pool with a loud gurgling and splashing.
"Noisy, isn't it?" he said proudly.
"Won't that make sleep in these surrounding rooms a little hard?" Geryon asked.
"It's also going to make listening almost impossible," the little man said smugly. "As soon as it gets dark, why don't you and I and Sadi and Lyselle gather here? We need to talk, and my cheerful little waterfall should cover what we say to each other."
"Why after dark?"
Silk slyly laid one finger alongside his long, pointed nose. "So that the night will hide our lips from those police who don't use their ears to listen with."
"Oh, that's clever," Geryon said.
"Why, yes, I thought so myself."
Then Silk made a sour face.
"Actually, it was Lyselle's idea," he confessed.
Geryon smiled.
"But she let you do the work," Silk grunted. "She claimed that she didn't want to break any of her fingernails. I was going to refuse, but she threw her dimples at me. And I gave in."
"She uses those very well, doesn't she? They're more dangerous than your knives."
"Are you trying to be funny, Geryon?"
"Would I do that, old friend?" As the soft spring evening descended over Malzeth, Geryon joined his three friends in the dim atrium beside Silk's splashing waterfall.
"Very nice work, Galdar,"
Velvet complimented the little man.
"Oh, shut up."
"Why, Galdar."
"All right," Geryon said, by way of calling the meeting to order. "What have we got that we can work with? Belgrath wants us out of Malzeth almost immediately."
"I have been following your advice, Belgarion," Zadi murmured. "And I have been concentrating my attention on Baron Vaska. He is a man of eminent corruption, and he has his fingers in so many pies that he sometimes loses track of just who is bribing him at any given moment."
"Exactly what is he up to right now?"
"He's still trying to take over the Bureau of Military Procurement,"
Velvet reported.
"That bureau is controlled by the general staff, however. It's mostly composed of colonels, but there's a General Bregar serving as bureau chief. The colonels aren't too greedy, but Bregar has a large payroll. He has to spread quite a bit of money around among his fellow generals to keep Vaska in check."
Geryon thought about that.
"Aren't you bribing Vaska as well?" he asked Silk.
Silk nodded glumly. "The price is going up, though. The consortium of Mersenne merchant barons is laying a lot of money in his path, trying to get him to restrict Yarblick and me to the West Coast."
"Can he raise any sort of force? Fighting men, I mean."
"He has contacts with a fair number of robber chiefs," Sadi replied. "And they have some pretty rough-and-ready fellows working for them."
"Is there any band operating out of Malzeth right now?"
Sadi coughed rather delicately.
"I just brought a string of wagons down from Kamat," he admitted. "Agricultural products for the most part."
Geryon gave him a hard look.
"I thought I asked you not to do that anymore."
"The crop had already been harvested, Belgarion," the eunuch protested. "It doesn't make sense to just let it rot in the fields, does it?"
Oh, that is sound business thinking, Geryon, Silk interceded. Anyway, Zadi hurried on, the band that's handling the harvesting and transport for me is one of the largest in this part of Meloria. 200 or 300, anyway. And I have a goodly number of stout fellows involved in local distribution.